Why did Donald Trump follow Barack Obama into the White House? Why is America so polarized? And how does American exceptionalism explain these social changes? These are some of the questions author and Stanford University law fellow Mugambi Joye tackles in his new book, Exceptional America: What Divides Americans from the World and from Each Other. Mugambi Joye joins me for a conversation. I hope you will as well today on The Keenest Observers. Mugambi Joye is the Stanford University Thomas C. Gray Fellow Lecturer in Law. His research focuses on U.S. criminal law, constitutional law, and policymaking from a multidisciplinary perspective, encompassing history, sociology, political science, and the humanities. Exceptional America, What Divides Americans from the World and from Each Other, is a comprehensive book on the relationship between American exceptionalism and the intense polarization of modern American society. His research covers a broad range of issues, including mass incarceration, the death penalty, policing, healthcare reform, socioeconomic rights, among others. Mugambi Joye, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
So let's jump right into it. What is American exceptionalism?
Most people today think that American exceptionalism means a faith in American superiority, that America is a special country chosen by God to be a beacon of light to the world. From this angle, American exceptionalism would mean exceptional in a sense of outstanding, phenomenal, or superior. However, historically, this is not what American exceptionalism has primarily meant. Instead, it's primarily meant that America is an exception, objectively and descriptively, especially compared to other Western democracies. So, for example, today, America is the only Western democracy to still have the death penalty and the only one to lack a universal health care system. And these are dimensions of American exceptionalism, of America being an exception, but they are not inherently good or bad. It depends on what people think of the death penalty and universal health care.
Mm-hmm. I see. And you take a definite tact in comparing America to the Western world as a formal means of analysis in your book. Why did you decide to kind of confront the issues in this fashion?
So my book aims to analyze how America not only has been very polarized under the presidency of Donald Trump, but also during the presidencies of Barack Obama, George W. Bush, and earlier, and how this polarization is really extraordinary by international standards, because Americans tend to clash over a broad range of issues that are either not controversial or much less controversial elsewhere in the Western world, such as whether people should have a basic right to health care, whether special interests should be allowed to spend unlimited money on political campaigns and on lobbying, whether climate change is a hoax or scientific reality, whether to teach creationism or the theory of evolution in public schools, whether women should have a right to abortion, whether contraception should be covered by people's health insurance, whether to teach abstinence-only sex education or comprehensive sex education, whether people should have an unbridled right to bear arms, whether to have the death penalty, whether to have mass incarceration on a scale not only unprecedented in American history, but virtually unprecedented in the history of humankind, and whether it is appropriate to introduce torture into Western civilization as a means of fighting terrorism. These types of issues, again, are either not controversial or much less controversial elsewhere in the Western world, leaving aside a few exceptions like abortion in Ireland and Poland, and explain why America is so polarized, because the U.S. Political, social, and legal debate is very peculiar by international standards.
And how so? I think I'm going to ask that and then kind of connect it also to the fact that you are a very well-read and broadly traveled and worked person. And I'd like to have you answer why that is and how your own background kind of informs, you know, your work and your perspective.
So this is a product of different dimensions of American exceptionalism in the original sense of the phrase, of America being an exception, especially compared to other Western democracies, that is, European nations, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, because of unique dimensions of American history, culture, politics, law, economic attitudes, religious beliefs, race relations, foreign policy, and beyond. And I'll be happy to discuss some of these different factors in depth. But what also shaped my perspective here, as you mentioned, is that I've lived in many different parts of the world and also many different parts of the U.S. So unlike Barack Obama, I was actually born in Kenya. My father is Kenyan. My mother is French. And after being born in Nairobi, I grew up in Paris before moving to the U.S. For college, going from Paris, France, not to Paris, Texas, but to Houston, Texas, to attend college. And then I lived in other regions of America, from New York City to Chicago and California. I also spent a lot of time in New England, as well as stretches in D.C., in Alabama and Georgia, and traveled to many other parts of the U.S. As well. And I've lived in not only France and Kenya, but the Netherlands and Mexico. And I was really fascinated with the contrast, not only between America as a whole and other Western nations, but also the huge contrast within the U.S. And it may seem obvious at first that there's, of course, a major regional divide in America that long preceded the U.S. Civil War between North and South. But what people tend to overlook is that the magnitude of the regional divide in America is really extraordinary by international standards. If you leave Paris for more rural regions of France, you may meet people who have more conservative mindsets. And if you do leave other parts of Europe for rural areas, you might as well.
Mugambi, let me interrupt you, and we'll get right back to you after on the break. I'd like to start right back where you're speaking now. But if you're joining us, I'm Robert Goodwin. My guest is Mugambi Jue, and we're talking about his book, Exceptional America: What Divides Americans from the World and Each Other. Stay with us. To the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Robert Goodwin. We're talking about the challenges of American polarization with author Mugambi Jue. You are invited to join us. Join the conversation. Call us at 800-838-3760 or email comments and questions to jx@jeffnet.org. Mugambi Jue, you were about to get into the differences that you've observed politically across America. I'd love for you to continue.
Yes. So overall, the regional divide in America is really extraordinary by international standards. So if one were to leave Paris for rural regions of France, one may meet people with more conservative outlooks, and same thing with other Western European nations. But one would rarely meet people who widely oppose universal health care, who think that everyone should have a right to bear arms, and who think that abortion is one of the greatest evils that the world has ever known. But these types of beliefs are quite common in the United States, partly due to a peculiar conception of conservatism, which is very different compared to other Western nations.
You're right. You get into some really provocative claims in this realm. You, in your thesis, the broad-ranging thesis, if I can have some range to kind of get into your very exhaustive work, offer that conservatism, fundamental Christianity, and anti-intellectualism provide a huge schism within American culture, but most definitely when it's compared to Western culture, is very divergent. Can you explain the, crux of your thesis?
So one example is that universal health care is far more controversial in America than other Western democracies, as well as other developed nations like Japan. And that is largely because of a peculiar conception of conservatism that is viscerally suspicious of big government taxes and regulation, which are perceived as the root causes of all economic problems. And that attitude is also fostered by the weight of conspiracy theories in the American social and political debate, so that many Americans are convinced that America has the best healthcare system in the world, and that they spend much less on healthcare than countries with universal healthcare, which is the exact opposite. The U.S. spends much more on its healthcare system than other Western democracies, and people have much less access. But a lot of people don't realize that, or are influenced by politicians who promote ideas about the tyranny of socialized medicine. And another part of the picture are racial divisions in American history, which are much more influential than other Western democracies, because America has historically been the Western nation with by far the highest proportion of racial and ethnic minorities. So looking back at the Civil War, that's a perfect example of how these sorts of issues have long been very divisive in America. And with regard to universal health care, it's also part of the picture because many opponents of Obama's health care reform, sometimes described as Obamacare, argued that it's essentially a handout for racial and ethnic minorities, which is not factually correct. But these types of claims lead many citizens to become very suspicious of the federal government's policies and to vote against their self-economic interest in opposing universal health care.
Right. You set a real nice argument in a historical kind of framework and context in the book that looks at the history of the Enlightenment and the Founding Fathers' arrival here through even the exploration of Alexis de Tocqueville and his observations of early America. But it is interesting that when we talk about race in that and slavery, especially during that time, and most definitely the Native American shift of land, to say it very diplomatically, there is an absence of the moral and ethical ramification, even in parallel, you know, to this very enlightened period of time that then became arguably not as enlightened. How does that? You know, how is that a foundation, you know, to what we're seeing now?
Yes. So overall, America has long been a nation of contradictions. As you mentioned, from the outset, there was persecution and the massacre of Native Americans and the takeover of their land, with also the role of African slavery in American society, and not to forget the fact that women had very few rights at the outset of the nation's rise. But it's also worth noting that America was still a pioneer in the development of democracy and human rights worldwide. In fact, America is the first modern Western democracy to emerge from the Enlightenment. The American Revolution of 1776 preceded the French Revolution of 1789, and that has also played a big role in shaping some of the peculiar mindsets that I describe in the book, including the weight of anti-intellectualism, which is skepticism of education. Because with the birth of modern democracy in the United States came an egalitarian spirit, and of course there were many contradictions, including slavery. But with this egalitarian spirit came a populist conception of democracy that started equating education with elitism, and that fostered the notion that people really don't need to be too educated because common sense is just good enough to understand the world and to make money. And this anti-intellectual mindset is very common today among certain politicians and citizens, and it helps shape the role of conspiracy theories in the U.S. political debate. But it has really old roots, which are really fascinating.
We're talking to Mugambi Jiwe, author and lawyer and fellow at Stanford University, about the polarization of America. I have a call with a question about how U.S. has become an anti-educational country. Anne and Eugene.
Thank you. I've got one comment and one question. And the comment is, I hope you've read Colin Woodard's American Nations. It was written a few years back. And the question is, would you go into more about how the United States became such an anti-intellectual country? Thank you.
Thank you, Anne.
So in terms of how the U.S. became an anti-intellectual country, I described the historical roots a moment ago, but what's also really interesting is that Americans also were pioneers in the development of a free primary and secondary school education in the 19th century. They did so before Europe, and today also America has among the very best universities in the world. And it's striking that notwithstanding the tremendous contributions of Americans to the development of education, if not the spread of modern science, and also America's major contributions to literature and the arts, that there's also a major anti-intellectual mindset in parts of the country. It's also important to understand that anti-intellectualism should not be mistaken for stupidity or a lack of education per se. Rather, it's a peculiar conception of education that can be held by even people who are very intelligent and college educated. And it fosters a notion that people really should not try to be too educated, that at most they should learn things that have a very practical use in their careers, and that being too educated, in fact, is a hindrance to common sense.
Yeah, you talk about it in your book being the ethic of educated folk being, in some stances, especially male, being effeminate and not doers, versus, you know, folk who have common sense being doers and constructors. And so the thought is being that the constructors are the more functional members of society versus the thinkers.
Exactly. That's at the heart of this anti-intellectual mindset. And it's also shaped America's political debate for a very long time. So Thomas Jefferson was actually criticized by his opponents for being a philosopher, a man who lived in his ivory tower, who had all his sophisticated, learned ideas, but who did not know how to be a man of action. The same criticism was repeated against John Quincy Adams and many politicians throughout American history, and it has led some politicians to deliberately adopt an anti-intellectual style to basically show themselves as men of action, not men of profound thought, in view of getting votes. And another part of the picture is the effort of some politicians to appear like the average Joe, the type of guy you can have a beer with, in order to seem relatable and to get support from the average voter.
Yes, yes. I'd like to switch gears to a certain degree. You take a significant portion of space in your book talking about the influence of Christian fundamentalism as it relates to politics, government, and economics. Could you explain a little bit about that dynamic and how that history kind of went from Enlightenment to evangelicism and fundamentalism?
So Christian fundamentalism is different from mere religious conservatism because millions of conservatives throughout the world do not interpret the Bible literally. According to data, between a third and 40% of Americans are creationists. We think that God created human beings in their present form and that the theory of evolution is false. A similar proportion believe in apocalyptic biblical prophecies about the imminent second coming of Christ. These types of radical Christian beliefs are very unusual in a modern Western world, except in the United States. And within the United States, they are primarily concentrated in conservative America. At the same time, another substantial proportion of Americans lean towards liberal or moderate conceptions of Christianity, and that calls into question the notion that America is primarily divided between believers and non-believers. The divide is mainly between people of faith, even though there's been an uptick in a number of people who are not religiously affiliated. And also what's striking here is that, in fact, many of the founding fathers, especially some of the most influential ones like Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and Thomas Paine, were skeptical of Christian dogma. And among those who held Christian beliefs, they were much more moderate in their views, such as John Adams. And however, with the rise of evangelicalism in the 19th century, there was a split of American Protestantism, and that has endured to this day into different conceptions of Christianity, with, on one hand, Christian fundamentalists who have resisted modernity, and on the other hand, liberal or moderate Christians who have embraced it. And that reflects itself also in support for issues like the right to abortion or gay rights.
And then in those groupings of folk have now I want to say infiltrated, but that's a bad word and a charged word, I should say, have become a part of the GOP politic and have influenced policy in a very particular and specific way. How has that particular politic or fundamental Christianity affected those policies in that work?
Religion tends to play a far bigger role in American politics and law than in other Western democracies. And that not only shapes very hardline positions on social policy issues like abortion or gay rights with regard to Christian fundamentalists, it can also shape a broader ideology that extends beyond religion by shaping very hardline, authoritarian, anti-rational, black and white mindsets. And that also helps explain why many of the people who are Christian fundamentalists today tend to be market fundamentalists, that is, people convinced that big government is the cause of virtually all economic problems, which is a very hard line and peculiar ideology by international standards. And that's because there's a parallel between how they think about religion and how they think about the economy in terms of emphasizing ideological purity. And the religious right movement has played a big role in the political, social, and legal debates in the last 30 years, and that is also one of the major sources of polarization today.
Right. You say that the effect on winner-take-all economics with fundamental economics is parallel. How do winner-take-all economics affect holistic policymaking for the greater good, as you say in your book?
So in the last 30 years or so, there's been a surge of wealth inequality in the U.S. that has been much worse than in other Western democracies. Today, America is the Western nation with the sharpest degree of wealth inequality. It's also the one without a universal health care system, and the one where lobbying and political spending by special interests has by far the most influence. And the rise of this winner-take-all economics is also in part due to, like I said, the parallel between market fundamentalism and Christian fundamentalism, because the divide between, say, economic conservatives and social conservatives has somewhat dissipated. Today, and that's a major part of polarization, Americans who hold conservative views tend to hold very hardline positions on both economic and religious issues, and they tend to reinforce each other in their perspective.
I'm Robert Goodwin. My guest today is author and lawyer Mugambi Ajuwe, and we're talking about polarization in America, and we'll come back after a short break. Stick with us. We're back with the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Robert Goodwin, hosting. My guest is author and Stanford Law Fellow Mugambi Ajuwe, and we're talking about his book, Exceptional America, What Divides Americans from the World and Each Other. You're welcome to join this conversation. Call us at 800-838-3760 or email comments and questions to jx@jeffnet.org. Mugambi Ajuwe, your book is exhaustive, and it is you've done an incredible job in making specific claims and backing it up with historical reference, and I would encourage anyone who wants to pick up the book, regardless of their point of reference or view, to check it out, because it is a very well thought and backed up book. That being said, its breadth is exceptional as well. I'm trying to get to everything, but you get into everything from democracy and plutocracy, and I'd like to touch that right now, all the way to like our challenge in terms of the ethic of mass incarceration and gun violence, and the idea that maybe the American dream isn't exactly a reality. But going back to this idea of democracy versus plutocracy, what are you seeing in terms of economic distribution in our country and how that parallels to the world?
Plutocracy means a government by the rich or the wealthiest members of society, which is an objective way to describe the way that American government works in many different dimensions today, such as the incredible influence of lobbying over government. And that shapes many different dimensions of American exceptionalism, such as the lack of a universal health care system, the greater hostility towards climatic science because of the role of polluting industries and lobbying against regulation and in promoting pseudoscientific studies alleging that climate change is a myth, and also the role of the National Rifle Association in blocking gun control and other moderate reforms. And overall, it also plays a big role in explaining why America has become so divided, because we see historically a correlation between polarization and wealth inequality. And just as we see also a correlation between wealth inequality and mass incarceration, that the more unequal a society appears to be, the likelier it seems to incarcerate people and adopt very harsh attitudes towards criminal justice.
Yes. One of the things that was very striking about the alignment and parallel that you offer in the book is you had several quotes of philosophers that said, if you want to see the nature of a country's society, look at their prison system.
Yes. So Albert Camus, the French novelist and philosopher, reportedly said that you can judge a society by its prisons. And Fyodor Dostoevsky, the Russian intellectual, wrote that the degree of civilization in a society can be judged by entering its prisons. And that's because one can tell how much a society values human dignity, not by how it treats the most privileged members of society, but by how it treats the worst of the worst. If it can recognize that even people convicted of serious crimes have fundamental constitutional rights and human dignity, and should still be treated with a degree of compassion, then that's a good benchmark for where a society is. And as I mentioned, we see a parallel between wealth inequality and harshening social attitudes towards crime, and America reaching mass incarceration levels on a scale that is practically unprecedented in the history of the world.
Yeah. You set up this really interesting parallel between the rest of the world, and I could say that it's definitely the Western world and America, and kind of make the parallel between the difference of, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, one that you do use, social democracy versus capitalism. And I'm wondering if those ethics or that ethos is what you're seeing play out in terms of practical application, in terms of social institutions. It seems that that's the thesis that you offer across the board in the book, with of course a very balanced point of analysis, I should say, to the listening public as well.
Social democracy is a complex type of system, but it is not categorically opposed to capitalism. If that refers to a market economy where people can hold private property. In fact, social democracy is a pragmatic form of socioeconomic system which recognizes that a market economy may serve the greater good in some ways, but that it should be checked by social policies and regulations that will make society more equal, such as ensuring that the basic healthcare needs of the people are met, that the country has good schools, so on and so forth. And social democracy is much more widely accepted in the rest of the Western world and other parts of the developed world like Japan than in the United States. And that's also part of the reason for the divide. Whereas in the U.S., actually, there's a polarization between citizens who tend to favor a more social democratic model and those who tend to favor a type of system where the government would have a very minimal role in society, and that relates to what we talked about with universal health care being much more controversial in the United States than other developed nations.
We have a couple of questions on board. One person asks if the biggest divide in America is between blacks and whites. I would love to hear how you integrate this into the conversation.
There's a longstanding racial divide within the U.S. I don't know if the biggest divide is between the blacks and whites per se, but as I mentioned, racial and ethnic divisions have played a big role in polarizing American society throughout history. So the Civil War between North and South was largely a clash over slavery and the status of African Americans. By the same token, the civil rights movement in 1960s played a big role in polarizing America and reshaping the alignment of political parties. That's because before the Democratic Party embraced civil rights legislation, it used to have a lot of support among Southern whites who often supported segregation and who also were a big part of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal and post-New Deal coalition. And one of different factors behind the Democratic Party's difficulties in the South was that backlash over civil rights and racial integration. So overall, these racial and ethnic issues have played a big role in American society in promoting polarization, and that's not a new phenomenon.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. It's very historic. I'm at this stage in my life, I'm seeing a parallel between the history that I know of Europe and colonialism, and most definitely America and slavery, and how the difference between the social democratic forces that are somewhat humanistic and the forces that are capitalistic in America have kind of, you know, you see the trickle down within the historical context to the challenges that are anything from immigration to our construct and an ethical challenge in America between now what it is to have benefited from centuries of free labor that have given us such a forward momentum in comparison to the rest of the world, and then seeing the backlash that was and is the backlash to the New Deal policies that set humanistic efforts out to the world, depending on your point of view. And now we're seeing a backlash, if you will, or a counter in what is now the descendants of Ronald Reagan and the Tea Party and conservative and fundamental politics. It's a very interesting time.
Definitely. And what's interesting also with regard to the New Deal is that it was widely supported by many whites in that epoch. That's partly because the New Deal was implemented in a racially discriminatory manner at the request of segregationists in the South, but it's also because most people saw that the help of the federal government then was for the greater good. But starting in the 1980s with the Reagan Revolution, there was a growing tendency to not only believe in market fundamentalism, the notion that big government taxes and regulation are the causes of all economic problems, but also a tendency to conflate government assistance with assistance for black people on welfare or racial minorities as a whole, and leading a lot of citizens to vote against their self-economic interests by not seeing public assistance as something for them, but something that's primarily for people who don't deserve it and people that they can't identify with.
I'm talking to Mugambi Jouwe, author of Exceptional America, What Divides Americans from the World and Each Other. I'd like to take a call. Connie and Eugene, you're on the air.
Hey, gentlemen. Fascinating. Thank you very much for the program. One of the things I've long wondered while pondering America is a personality, if you will, of America, or a genetics of America. In other words, we are unique even among the new countries of the Western Hemisphere of having allowed or encouraged people from multiple ethnic backgrounds, multiple religious backgrounds, sometimes encouraged or discouraged, but they came to America. But especially, people had to come here. In other words, if they weren't fitting in for whatever reason in their native country, they came to America. And I've often wondered, you know, those who had the extra oomph to came here, those who again, didn't fit in for whatever reason, came here. And so we have this population of persons that have a certain personality that made them leave their native country, whether it's Europeans hundreds of years ago or Caribbeans or Africans or Asians today. People are coming here, and I wondered how that drive to come here then passes through generations and creates sort of a national personality. Thank you.
Thank you, Connie.
It's true that the drive of people who immigrate may be part of the picture. That being said, it probably would not be the main explanation for the difference between America and other Western democracies, because other parts of the West, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, have also relatively comparable roots in terms of Europeans who moved to remote parts of the world. But these countries widely accept universal health care and are far less polarized over the issues that I mentioned. But it's also interesting that on one hand, America has been a haven for people around the world seeking freedom, but also there have been many contradictions, such as the Chinese Exclusion Act in the 19th century, which has been forgotten. But we see parallels between this law and proposals to ban Muslims from entering America, which were at the heart of Donald Trump's presidential campaign and also appear to be reflected in some of his executive orders as president.
Yeah, in the last few seconds or 30 seconds that we have, actually, last seconds, I need to thank you for being here. Mugambi Joe, thanks for joining us. And please, most definitely, check out his book, Exceptional America, What Divides Americans from the World and from Each Other. I really appreciate you being here today.